From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we compare the cooking in America's Chinatowns with the cooking of China and Hong Kong. My guest Ken Hom is an expert on Chinese cooking. Also, trumpeter Lester Bowie tells us about the R&B bands he played with before co-founding the seminal avant-garde jazz band, the Art Ensemble of Chicago. Music critic Milo Miles reviews David Byrne's Brazil Classic series. It's the latest example of an American rock star taking inspiration from world music. And Patricia McLaughlin compares advertising's old Breck girl with the new Breck woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. About 5,000 East Germans packed inside the West German embassy in Prague today burst into cheers when it was announced they would be allowed to emigrate to the West. The first buses and cars filled with refugees have already left the embassy. More than 4,000 Bulgarians rallied outside the National Assembly today in Sofia in the country's first mass protest in four decades of communist rule. The cheering but orderly crowd had joined a brief march organized by the unofficial ecology group Eco Glasnost to present a petition on environmental problems to the National Assembly. In contrast to sweeping democratic changes in Hungary and Poland, restructuring in Bulgaria has so far been limited to attempts to streamline the stagnating economy. The South African foreign minister, Pik Botha, has acknowledged that it may have been false information, which led him to claim earlier this week that SWAPO guerrillas were infiltrating Namibia from Angola before next week's Namibian elections. The BBC's Geraldine Farley reports from Cape Town.
Mr. Botha says that if the messages that were allegedly monitored on a United Nations frequency were in fact a hoax, he would be the first person to be overjoyed. But he claimed in a statement that there was no doubt about the authenticity of the messages he had of increased military activity on the Angolan border by guerrillas of the Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO. Mr. Botha said the information indicated that several hundred SWAPO fighters were poised to cross the border and that convoys had been observed in the area. He called on foreign governments to ensure that the Namibian elections were not derailed by violence, and went on to say that it was of decisive importance to his government that the elections should proceed peacefully.
The BBC's Geraldine Farley. The Labor Department reports unemployment was unchanged last month at 5.3%. The nation's jobless rate has changed little in over a year. Michael Richards has more.
There were new job opportunities in October, but not very many of them. They were mainly in the service-producing sector of the economy, especially in education as the new school year picked up steam. According to Janet Norwood, the Commissioner of Labor Statistics, what's kept the unemployment rate from rising is the fact that very few people are out looking for their first job.
Thus, the number of unemployed persons has remained essentially stable. In fact, the civilian jobless rate and the rates for most worker groups have fluctuated without any clear trend over the past year.
Norwood says it's part of a trend that Labor Department projections show continuing through the 1990s. But Norwood warns if there's a big surge in the economy, there could be labor shortages and wages will go up. But for now, with the economy only growing slowly, things appear on an even keel. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2 points to close at 2629.51. Declines led advances 7-6. This is NPR News. A Coast Guard search party has dropped a lighted buoy in the water, hoping that its drift will lead them to a Customs Service drug agent missing since a helicopter crash off the Florida coast last night. Rick Stone reports from Miami.
The five known survivors said the Black Hawk helicopter shuddered and crashed within seconds last night as it chased suspected drug smugglers 50 miles south of Marathon in the Florida Keys. Three Customs Service officers and two Bahamian policemen were rescued by a passing naval vessel, but the sixth man aboard has not been found. The water is warm and the downed flyer is well equipped, but Customs Pilot Supervisor Robert Viator says the search will be difficult.
It's a very, very difficult thing to find a person who's real small in a big, big ocean, and it's tough.
A combined Customs and National Transportation Safety Board team has begun its inquiry into the cause of the crash. None of the other crewmen was seriously injured or publicly identified. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
The Canadian government unveiled an abortion law today that allows a woman to end her pregnancy at any time if a doctor believes her life or health is threatened. The legislation will fill the void created when the Supreme Court struck down a more restrictive law last year, but will end what has become a practice of abortion on demand in some areas that has resulted from a lack of an abortion law. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney's government had promised new legislation since the previous law was declared unconstitutional in January of 1988. Philippine troops used water cannon and tear gas today to drive off thousands of supporters of the late Ferdinand Marcos, who massed at the National Police headquarters to demand that Marcos' body be brought home for burial. Marcos was forced into exile in 1986 after being deposed as president. He died in Hawaii in September at the age of 72. President Corazon Aquino has refused to allow his body to be brought to the Philippines. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Americans seem to be more sophisticated about Chinese food than we used to be. More of us go out for dim sum, and fewer of us utter the words chop suey. My guest Ken Hom is an authority on the traditional cooking styles of China and the Americanization of Chinese cooking in U.S. Chinatowns. He grew up in Chicago, now lives in San Francisco, and makes frequent trips to Hong Kong. His new book, Fragrant Harbor Taste, is about the food of Hong Kong. Its stature as an international city has made Hong Kong the center of innovation in Chinese cooking. Influences from around the world have been absorbed by Hong Kong chefs, and the chefs have access to the finest Chinese ingredients. But it's only recently that Hong Kong became an important place for culinary innovation.
For a long time, Hong Kong did not have any sort of impact on Chinese cooking because Hong Kong was trying to get itself together. In other words, you know, after 1949, after the communists took over the mainland, you know, Hong Kong was very, you know, chaotic. And during the 50s, I think Hong Kong had that image of like sort of cheap. Remember when you're too young to remember.
Oh, no, I'm not. Made in Hong Kong.
They used to have these cheap transistor radios, you know, junky things from Hong Kong, plastic flowers and things like that. And I think what started to happen was in the mid-60s when Hong Kong started getting really prosperous and becoming very cosmopolitan, things started really happening very fast. And in the 70s, you know, with the opening to China, of course, Hong Kong just took off. And what took off with it was its food also.
Well, make me hungry. What's one of the popular dishes being served now in Hong Kong restaurants?
Well, there's this one which is that makes actually my mouth is watering as I'm talking to you, which is a slice of an apple pear, which is a Chinese pear, put together with a thin sort of a shrimp paste, and then it's put together with a scallop like a sandwich, and it's rolled into a very thin flour and deep fried, and it's so delicious because when you put it in your mouth, you have the sweetness of the pear apple, and you have the wonderful seafood flavor of the scallops and the shrimp, and the combination is just out of this world. It's pure ecstasy.
Is this a new dish?
Certainly it is. It's certainly not a traditional Chinese dish, and it's certainly a reflection of the chef who invented this, which is quite a well-known chef who works at a restaurant called Lai Jing Hing, which is in at the Regent Hotel. And he is very good because he has the backing of the Regent, which is the international hotel, which has a great deal of money. And so he's able to practice and create things.
You know, in your book, you say that it's now illegal to use cat or dog meat for human consumption. Is that considered like a delicacy in Hong Kong?
Well, it is because people feel that eating cat and dog keeps you warm in the winter. It's illegal, well, partly because of the British, SPCA, and being a dog lover, I've never sampled it myself, and I wouldn't. My dogs would never forgive me. But there are places, though, I think in the new territory, so I've heard rumors that people still tend to eat dog, or else what they do is they cross the border into Canton to have their dog stew.
Did people eat cat and dog because it was accessible and cheap or because it was considered a tasty meat?
It's sort of both. Actually, that's a very interesting question because they ate a dog because they think it's also has medicinal properties. They feel that it's good for your blood. And there's a certain type of dog that they eat. They don't just, you know, eat any type of...
mutt.
Yeah, right. Or a nice fluffy sheepdog or something like that. It has to be a certain type of black dog.
Hong Kong reverts from British sovereignty to Chinese in 1997, which is really not very far away at all. Do you think that's going to affect the sense of innovation in Chinese cooking there?
Well, it's a very controversial question, and I think eventually it will. I think it won't happen right away. Maybe in 20 years from now, it certainly won't have, I think, the creativity or innovation, unless, you know, the government changes in China, the system changes. Because, you know, you need a sort of a atmosphere or form of democracy to create. You need freedom to create. You need to, it's a certain mentality. You have to think that you're free so that you can do something new. And if you don't feel free, you don't feel like creating because you're afraid of what's going to happen if you do something, you know, if you deviate from the line. And that goes for food too. You know, if this dish is supposed to be like this and it's not, well, you know, you can get in trouble for it.
Ken Ham is my guest, and he's an authority on Chinese cooking and the author of several cookbooks, including his new one, Fragrant Harbor Taste. Well, let's talk a little bit about, some of the basics of Chinese cooking. There's a lot of Chinese dishes that are centered either around stir-frying or deep-frying. Do you have a sense of why so many Chinese dishes are fried?
Well, the thing is... I think that it's a misperception that a lot of Chinese things are fried. I think it's because Chinese restaurants in Western countries, you know, and that includes Europe and Australia and other places I've been to, they tend to think Westerners like things crispy. And so they fry everything for them. That's why on menus you see everything fried. If you, go to, a Chinese meal in Hong Kong, only one dish might be fried. And the thing is... things are stir-fried a lot simply because, you know, China traditionally has been fuel short. And to stir-fry a good dish takes an exquisite skill because everything is in terms of not even a split second, but a millisecond. And so you have to be very, very skilled, especially to cook professionally in walks. And I tell you, I've observed chefs, Chinese chefs all over the world, and I tell you, Hong Kong chefs have really got their act together.
You know what I love? You go into some place where they have their kitchen exposed, and they have, like, stir-fried vegetables on the menus. And I'm talking about American restaurants, not Chinese-American restaurants. They put in, like, an inch of oil on the bottom of the wok. They throw in some vegetables and stir it around, and you have, like, vegetables and oil soup.
It's gruesome,
really,
isn't it?
Is.
I know. That's bad cooking. I have to say that lots of cooking in China is like that.
Is it really?
Oh, God. You're swimming in oil.
What's your favorite oil for stir frying?
Well, peanut oil. I tell you why. You know, peanut oil doesn't have cholesterol. But like all oils, oils have fat. But peanut oil is very good because it can be heated up to a very high temperature, which is what you need to stir-fry food properly. Because once it's very hot, you don't need that much oil, and you plunge it in and quickly, you know, stir-fry it. And what people make the mistake of doing is when they're stir-frying vegetables is they tend to add more oil when they think that the vegetables are going to burn. You know, they start panicking and say, oh, my God, you know the vegetables are going to burn and I'm going to be in trouble, so I'm going to keep adding more oil. Well, what they should do if they're stir-frying vegetables is add water, and that's what the Chinese do. They started off with oil, but they add water to finish it.
How come there's virtually no dairy in basic Chinese cooking?
Well, that comes from a Chinese tradition of needing the land to, grow food. I mean, they couldn't afford, you know, having a cow, you know, having dairy cows, and you really have to have a lot of pastoral land. And the thing is, China has always not had that luxury. They needed every single inch to grow food to feed its people. And so they, you know, never had a great need for a lot of dairy products. And also, a lot of Chinese, perhaps because of that, genetically, they have a lactose intolerance.
Hmm. I was surprised to read in your book that in a Chinese restaurant, I don't mean a Chinese-American restaurant, but a Chinese restaurant, that soup is used more as a beverage than as a course.
Yes, in fact, always. I think Chinese don't, like for instance, drink tea when you're eating food. you drink tea after the meal. Hmm. You never drink it during the meal. In fact, it's rather gauche to be sipping a cup of tea. And what you want to do is the soup is used to refreshen your palate. You know, the thing about Chinese is that when you eat, you eat. When you drink. You see, you don't eat and drink together.
Hmm. Well, let's talk more about food after we take a short break. And my guest is Ken Ham. He's an expert on Chinese cooking, the author of several cookbooks, including his new one, Fragrant Harbor Taste. And you might also have seen his public television series a couple of years ago, Ken Ham's Chinese Cookery. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ken Ham is my guest. I'll be honest with you. I have been to so many Chinese restaurants in America that I'm just so anxious to hear what you have to say about some of them. Now, you used to work in a Chinese restaurant, right? Your uncle, I think it was.
Many, many years ago.
Right, so when you were 11, was it, you worked
right.
in his restaurant?
It's a long time ago.
And you describe how he'd have two separate parts of the menu, one for the American customers and one right. for the Chinese. So what was the difference in what they'd serve to each?
Well, quite a bit of difference. They would serve the chop suey to the non-Chinese, right? And with the Chinese menu, we would have things like sea snail, you know, wonderful things like that. Conch we would have. Actually, real Chinese food.
Was there a lot of snickering at the Americans who came in and ordered chop suey?
Well, you know, this is part of the Chinese problem. You know, Chinese have a very bad sense of superiority. Even, I mean, you can see this ingrained even in the peasants in China. You know, since you're a kid, you're taught that, you know, I mean, the Chinese, you know, are a superior culture. So it's assumed if you're not Chinese that you don't understand anything, you know, how to eat well. And this is, of course, a total misconception. In fact, this is one of the main reasons why China is in such a mess, because China still has this mentality. But yes, there were sometimes, you know, I hate to admit, you know, snickering that, oh yeah, this is a non-Chinese, so let's give them this, you know, let's give them, you know, anything that we wouldn't eat. A good example is like a chicken. You know, all the breast meat always went to non-Chinese. Because the best stuff was the thighs and the legs and all that kind of stuff, because that's where all the flavor is and everything. And of course, it just falls into the thing that most non-Chinese do like, you know, chicken breasts. So it just reaffirms the, you know, the
right.
Chinese, you know, misconception that nobody knows how to eat other than the Chinese.
Now, you actually know something of the history of chop suey?
Well, you know, this is quite an interesting history. I think there are various stories. Actually, I would love to work on a book one day to track down the real history of chop suey, how it was made. Because, you know, the word chop suey actually comes from a Chinese word that means chop suey, which is, you know, all the rest thrown together. But in China, you know, chop suey is actually something very good. But I think what had happened is that a lot of people that came, you know, to work in America as Chinese immigrants, you know, the railroad workers weren't really cooks, and they just threw together a lot of, you know, junk together, and after they couldn't work on the railroads, they went to open up restaurants and laundries, and they decided to throw scraps together and just whip up something, and they probably used this word chop suey, you know, and thinking that people would love it, and of course, it's a way to use up leftovers.
Is there a similar story behind chow mein?
Chow mein is something very Chinese. And it's probably, you know, what we get as chow mein, you know, for a long time in America was actually a sort of American version of it. But chow mein, of course, goes to thousands of years of Chinese history.
You know, when I was a kid and we'd have Chinese food every Sunday night, we always had chow mein. And now when I go to Chinatown restaurants, I don't even see it on the menu.
You know, it shows you how Chinese food is changing in America. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, the evolution of Chinese restaurants and how they've moved from what you used to know as you know, Chinese food, you know, the sweet and sour pork and the sup gum. Do you remember that?
Yeah. And yes. Spare ribs, egg rolls.
Yes, and that sort of stuff. And now it's moving towards something which is more authentic. And actually what's really interesting is Hong Kong is having an enormous influence on Chinese restaurants all over the world, and especially in America, because a lot of these immigrants from Hong Kong are coming here and people are opening up restaurants to cater to those immigrants, because people in Hong Kong are used to good Chinese food. They have a very discerning palate. You know, they've been spoiled, and so they're demanding better food, and in the process, we Americans are benefiting from all that.
Well, you know, one thing I've noticed, though, is that there's still too few Chinatown restaurants that serve without MSG in it.
Well,
you still have to work to,
yes. Well,
to get food without it.
Well, you know what I think you have to do is that I think, in fact, I hope a lot of people are listening to this. When they go to Chinese restaurant, they say, we do not want MSG. And that's the great thing about Hong Kong restaurant. Good Hong Kong restaurants, I mean, it's a given that they don't serve MSG or put any MSG in their food. And I think, you know how it is in America. When the consumer wants something, right, they stop
That's right.
putting it in, right? You know, no ALAR in the apples and, you know, no MSG in Chinese food.
Well, how did it get there in the first place?
You know, it's an interesting history. I think, well, you know, MSG is actually invented by the Japanese. You know, Ajinomoto.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and that's what it's called. And it crept into China, I think, in the 20s. And, you know, people start using it to flavor, you know, sort of insipid broths, you know, things that didn't have meat, you know, to give it flavor. And, you know, because Chinese traditionally have used things like shrimp or dried fish to pep up things. And so MSG was something which is simple to use, and they just threw it in, and people started using it. It was a shortcut. And, of course, during the 20s and 30s, you know, during the war years, you know, a lot of the Chinese started using that as a shortcut to make things palatable.
Mm-hmm. Ken Ham is my guest, and he's an expert on Chinese cooking, the author of many books, including his new one, Fragrant Harbor Taste. Where were your parents from?
Well, my father was from here, the States, but my mother was from outside of Canton. And after the war, my father, you know, went back to China and met my mother. It makes a wonderful love story, and brought her over here.
What kinds of foods did you grow up eating?
Chinese food. I didn't speak English until I was about 6 years old, and I grew up with all kinds of noodles and rice. In fact, when I was a kid, my mother, you know the Chinese sausages?
No,
you ever
actually,
see them?
No.
They're, well, these Chinese sausages, they're sort of like dried, cured sausages. And, you know, while other kids in school used to have bologna sandwiches, my mother used to make a thermos for me of rice and Chinese sausages, which she put in the thermos, and I would carry that to school where everybody had sandwiches. But I used to trade them, you know, with the kids. They used to have my rice and sausage, and I used to eat their bologna sandwich because we were very curious about what each other was eating. Because they couldn't believe it, because I had a hot meal while they had this cold piece of meat, you know, with a piece of lettuce or mayonnaise on it.
Do you find that the best restaurant Chinese food in America is served in Chinatowns or in restaurants outside of the Chinatown districts?
I think it depends. Like, for instance, in San Francisco now, if you're talking about the West Coast, for instance, some of the best Chinese restaurants are outside of Chinatown. If you go to a place like Melbourne in Australia, the best Chinese restaurants are in Chinatown. If you go to a place like New York, I tend to think the best Chinese restaurants are in Chinatown in New York. I've been to a place in Chicago, some of the best Chinese restaurants are in Chinatown. It just depends on where the most, especially there's this influx of new immigrants, where they're going. In San Francisco, they tend to go outside of the Chinatown area, simply perhaps because it's so expensive.
You describe how in Chinese cooking, the rice is always served separately from whatever the other
right,
dishes.
The main dishes. Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're in the know, do you not mix it together like most Americans do?
Well, the thing is...
if you're Chinese... Stupid way of putting it.
No, it isn't. Oh, you mean if you're Chinese.
Yeah, exactly,
well, you know what I try to tell people is that, number one, we're not in China.
Right, you know, so don't worry. Yeah,
don't worry about that.
About being correct.
I mean, who cares? You know, as long as you have good wine, you have good friends, right? You put that together. I mean, you know, I think food should not have formality.
Why is the rice kept separately, though, in Chinese cooking?
Well, because, you know, rice is a symbol of purity. And the thing is, you eat something spicy. It's almost like bread, for instance. Do you put a main dish on your bread? No, you don't, right? You keep it separately.
Mm-hmm.
Because bread is, you know, sort of used to cleanse the palate, and it's used to go with the food. But you don't put your food on top of it. Well, if you look on rice as bread for the Chinese, then... You know, that's probably the main reason why.
I'm going to ask you to make us hungry again. You describe smoked garlic and say that the only place you've ever been able to find it is in Hong Kong. Describe how it's smoked and how it tastes.
Ah, it tastes wonderful. I think what they do is the same way they smoke, you know, ducks. They just put it in a smoker. You know, because a lot of things are cooked on charcoal in Hong Kong. And it's a good way also to preserve the garlic. In other words, if they're not going to use it and they're afraid that it will, you know, turn, a good way of keeping it for a longer time is to smoke it. And it has a nice, wonderful, sweet and rich taste to it. And you can, in fact, it's so wonderful that you can cook it whole and just eat it like a bit of French truffles almost.
That sounds good. okay, should I ask you the fortune cookie question?
Oh, God. Yes, let's hear it.
Why are there fortune cookies?
Because some ingenious Chinese was in Chinatown and saying, now how can I get Americans to come to my restaurant? Even though they don't like Chinese food. Actually, I got a funny story to tell you about that. Many, many years ago, about 10 years ago, I was in Lubbock, Texas, believe it or not, with a group from the Hong Kong Tourist Association. And we were trying to, you know... it was picked as the target area, I don't know why, to promote, you know, Hong Kong. And it was a very nice place, but we were with a troop of Chinese people, you know, who have never been to America before. They were dancers, they were noodle makers, and I was there to demonstrate cooking. And we went to a Chinese restaurant. Of course, the Chinese have to have Chinese food, you know. They saw these huge... 1.5-pound steaks that the Texans served us, and they couldn't believe it. You know, for each person, you know, the Chinese don't eat that much meat in a month, right? And they couldn't believe their eyes. So we went to this Chinese restaurant, and we ordered Chinese food and everything. It wasn't very good, but at the end, they bought them fortune cookies, and you should have seen the bewilderment on their faces. They couldn't believe it. They said, "What is this?" And I explained to them in Chinese that they burst out laughing. I mean, they've never seen anything like that. They thought it was very quaint, and they said, only in America.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us about food. Thank you. I've enjoyed
it. Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Ken Hom, and his new book is called Fragrant Harbor Taste, The New Chinese Cooking of Hong Kong. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Yeah.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's trumpeter Lester Bowie. He brings theatrical flair to his work with the Art Ensemble of Chicago and his ensemble Brass Fantasy. Coming up, Bowie tells us he got his sense of style playing on the road with rhythm and blues bands. Also, Milo Miles looks at the influence of world music at home in the States and reviews David Byrne's new record. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin thinks about Breck shampoo ads. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Private cars and at least two buses filled with East German refugees left the West German embassy in Prague for the West tonight, 1 hour after officials said that they could go. About 5,000 refugees had crowded into the mission this week, and many shouted freedom, freedom, when West German diplomats said that they could legally leave for the West by any means they like. Special trains will arrive Saturday, and many of the East Germans are expected to leave Prague by rail. East German leader Egon Krenz announced today that five members of the ruling Politburo will step down. All were closely tied to former party leader Erich Honecker. In Canada, the government introduced a new abortion law today. The country has been without any law regulating abortion for almost 2 years after the Supreme Court struck down the previous law. Richard Reynolds has more.
The new law was drafted in secret and came as something of a surprise. Parts of the bill were leaked yesterday, but previously no one had any inkling of what the government intended to do to replace the abortion law struck down in January 1988. Under the new law, it is illegal for a woman to procure an abortion unless a doctor decides that the woman's physical or mental health is in danger. But the law is quite vague and provides no definition of what constitutes a threat to a woman's health. The previous legislation required a committee of three doctors to make the decision. The result was that abortions were freely available in some regions and next to impossible to obtain in other parts of Canada. The actual effect of the new law will probably be to make abortions relatively easy to obtain right across the country. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
The need for special safety seating for children on airlines was discussed today during a National Transportation Safety Board hearing concerning last July's crash of a United Airlines flight in Sioux City, Iowa. Doug Johnson with member station KWIT reports.
Parents do not have to buy a ticket on domestic flights for children under two if the child rides on the adult's lap. Fidel Gonzalez of the Association of Flight Attendants questioned Walt Coleman of the Air Transport Association.
Do the airlines have a duty to provide passengers with the highest possible degree of safety?
Yes, it's in the FAA Act.
Well, then, do you feel that allowing an infant to sit on a lap provides the highest degree of safety?
I think the evidence would indicate it does not.
Coleman said that of the 18,500 domestic departures each day, an infant is on board nearly every flight. Inquiry into the crash of Flight 232 in Sioux City concluded today. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson in Sioux City, Iowa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 2 points to close at 2,629.51 on volume of 131 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In music, as elsewhere, strangers may be best introduced by mutual friends. World music commentator Milo Miles has the first of his two-part examination of rock stars with a taste for international sounds and a desire to convert their fans.
Welcome to the wonderful world of world music sponsors. For several years now, singers and rhythms from Africa, the Near East, and South America have had friends in high places on the hit parade. Paul Simon made the first big splash with Graceland, but recently David Byrne of Talking Heads has threatened to swallow Brazil whole, and Peter Gabriel has backed the starting of a new record label devoted entirely to world music. All this brings up the nasty question of exploitation. Are these well-off rockers simply ripping off little-known foreign musicians? Have Gabriel and Byrne run out of ideas and resorted to a kind of colonial patronage to spice up their careers? Are these guys imperialist pigs or what? Well, I think celebrity intervention is benign, even praiseworthy, when it comes to collecting and presenting anthologies of world music. A batch of strange-sounding songs are much more likely to be bought if they have a famous name attached to them. David Byrne has done a particularly fine job with his Brazil Classics series. The first collection, Beleza Tropical, came out earlier this year and served up a cornucopia of Brazilian pop, mostly by stars of the 60s and 70s. Women singers were a bit underrepresented, but there's lots of choice work by Jorge Ben, Gilberto Gil, Milton Nascimento, and Caetano Veloso. One woman who does get in some great licks is Nazaré Pereira. She shows off Brazilian melody at its best in Maculele. Byrne's second collection from Brazil is the just-released O Samba. Samba is plainly a folk form, made for bouncy, non-stop dancing. And the best sambas often appear during carnival celebrations, where they are performed by dozens of musicians and hundreds of dancers and singers. There are lots of recordings of carnival sambas, but all the ones I've heard sound like mass chaos and very repetitive. Stay away from carnival records and hear Byrne's O Samba instead. He keeps more variety than anybody else has managed, and the translations reveal the wit behind many sambas. My favorite is SPC, in which a jilted lover threatens revenge on his girl by getting her in trouble with the credit bureau.
Precisei de roupa nova, mas sem prova de salário. Combinamos, eu pagava, você fez o crediário. Nosso caso foi pra cova e a roupa pro armário. Nosso caso foi pra cova e a roupa pro armário. E depois você quis manchar meu nome dentro do meu métier. Esse é o pra moral de um homem. Vou me vingar de você porque eu vou sujar seu nome no SPC. Tu vai ver, eu vou sujar seu nome no SPC.
So far, so festive. But now Byrne has released an album of his own music with all sorts of Brazilian and general Latin American accompaniment and a small army of sidemen, including Willie Colon, Milton Cardona, Yomo Toro, and Johnny Pacheco. It's called Rei Momo, and it's all very authentic with plenty of spirited playing. The 15 different styles of rhythm in the background cut Byrne loose to be playful or ominous, scornful or soulful.
And they were imagining Moses as if
when I listen close and think about Rei Momo, I'm not so sure about it. A few of the numbers are very typical Byrne songs with just unexpected backing. And sometimes his twitty surrealism just goes over the top. At one point he sings, "You know that roses and lilacs are funky too. Get down, David." I guess what I'm saying is that about half the time, Ray Momo sounds like an exercise rather than an adventure. Byrne really does need a band of equals to say no to him ever so often. Still, I want to emphasize that for the other half of the time, he flies solo like an ace. When Byrne can construct a sassy vocal with pithy words snuggled right into the beat, Ray Momo can be a tropical holiday for the years. It's worth a visit, anyway.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for the Village Voice.
Though we struggle for our freedom, our need for others still remains. We know what will make us happy. We know what will ease our pain.
This is Fresh Air. The Art Ensemble of Chicago emerged from the experimental jazz scene of the 60s and still maintains its position as a premier avant-garde band. The group's founding trumpeter is my guest, Lester Bowie. In addition to his work with the Art Ensemble, he also leads his own group, Brass Fantasy. Bowie has developed a reputation for his off-kilter interpretations of rhythm and blues classics. Start playing rhythm and blues standards with the band?
Well, when I first started playing professionally at age 15, I played with a group called the Continentals that was backing up a lot of doo-wop groups during that time. This is 1954 to 59. And one of the first songs that I learned was The Great Pretender. So, assuming that jazz always expounded on contemporary music, I was always confused as to why jazz guys never really picked up on what was happening for the doo-wop guys in the 50s. So to pick up that slack and to fill that space, I decided to do it myself.
Did you ever turn your back on those songs yourself because they weren't jazz and you were a jazz musician?
No, I've always been a professional musician first. I always tell any student that I have that if you want to be a jazz musician, you first have to learn how to feed yourself with the instrument. After that, you can specialize. And another thing, we in jazz aren't supposed to be so closed-minded as to turn our backs on any kind of music.
Did playing with people like Solomon Burke and Jackie Wilson, Rufus Thomas, Gladys Knight, Patti LaBelle, give you a sense of the theater of music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And it taught me a lot about staging and just how music moves and how it affects people.
Did you do steps and wear jackets, and did you have synchronized horn movements?
I did the steps, we wore the jackets, but I didn't like the fast moves. You know, one time I auditioned for James Brown. Actually, I auditioned three times. I never got the gig, but I was always glad I didn't because I didn't want to flip my trumpet around like that. I was scared. That's the only trumpet I had.
Well, you mentioned James Brown. You do Papa's Got a Brand New Bag on your new record. Tell me why you chose that one.
Well, for two reasons. James Brown has been one of the influential people in music for the last, since I was in high school, since 1955. And his being incarcerated now, I think he shouldn't be incarcerated. I think we should free James Brown and put him in the nut house, take him out of jail and put him in the nut house. But he shouldn't be in jail like that. And this is just part of our homage and our respect for his music and what he's done for jazz and what it's done for rhythm and blues. What it's done for the rap music of today. He is truly the godfather of soul.
ask you about your playing. You tend to play in the cracks between notes a lot, and you do these flub notes that are perfectly controlled. You know exactly, or you seem to know exactly how you're going to miss a note. And I was wondering how you develop that kind of technique.
Well, I used to tell people I've built a whole career off making mistakes. What I do is, if I make a mistake, I just learn how to do it on purpose. So then I've got the note that I should have hit, then I get the note that I didn't hit, but I know how to make both of them on purpose.
Well, do you think of yourself as having a lot of technique as a player?
Well, I've probably got the most advanced technique in brass as far as the newer elements that I use. I don't have the best by any means as far as the standard trumpet classical technique, but who cares?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever care?
Nope, Fred, not. At the time, my father was a classical musician, trained as a classical musician in the 30s, and when he came up, there was no hope of a black man ever getting any, being with the symphony orchestra in the States, so I didn't even consider that. It was never part of my, never part of it. Mm-hmm. Plus, the music kind of bored me a little bit, too.
We were talking before about the theatricality of music and the matching jackets that you'd have to wear when you were playing with rhythm and blues bands and doo-wop groups. You wear a lab coat when you perform with Brass Fantasy. How did you start using that as your stage uniform?
Well, I started using I've used a lot of different ones. I've been a priest, I've been a hard hat. But the white jacket kind of stands for research. And I've been a researcher, and I consider the stage as my laboratory.
You always look to me like the mad scientist when you wear it. You know, that you're cooking something up in your laboratory.
Yeah, Jack Sheldon once told me that I was was like a psychiatrist gone berserk or something.
Let me change the subject to the Art Ensemble of Chicago. What part of your playing and your personality does that group bring out?
Well, the Art Ensemble is the artistic, the research, the multi-ethnic, influential, heavy. I believe this is the most difficult music that I play is with the Art Ensemble. I can play things with the Art Ensemble that everyone else wouldn't know what to do, but just hold their eyes open wide. So it's the most advanced musically of all the groups.
Did you think of yourself as being an avant-garde player when you helped form the group in 1965?
No, we didn't. We never considered ourselves avant-garde. I mean, people considered us avant-garde. We've been trying to live that down now for the last 25 years. So it's because avant-garde has a sort of a negative connotation. When people think of avant-garde, it means something that they're going to have difficulty understanding, something that's going to be maybe chaotic and... Avant-garde doesn't really mean that. It means just something that's a little bit ahead of its time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's atonal or it's a bunch of confusing sounds that may be difficult to decipher. So it's kind of hard to live that down, and that label was kind of stuck on us.
Well, the Art Ensemble is really a group that not only plays, you know, challenging music, but it's a group that really knows how to have fun, and that is also like Brass Fantasy into theatricality. Most of the members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago wear face paint for performances. I believe you usually don't.
I sweat too much. I'd have that paint all in my mouth. It'd be all down in my horn, up in my nose. So I don't use it.
Was there ever any pressure on you to do it so that you'd fit in with the way everybody else was?
No, there's no pressure to fit in, because if you fit in with the Art Ensemble, you fit out.
Right.
Because it's about being individual, and it's about expressing yourself any way you want to. The whole idea of the paint is the tradition of the mask, and in order to prepare yourself to play music, you try to put yourself on another level. You want to become out of yourself, become the music itself, you know? And to do this, it requires changing something. I don't want to look the same way I look walking down the street as I do when I walk on the stage, because on the stage is when I'm presenting my craft and when I really have to concentrate and get into what I'm doing. And the change of costumes, the paint, all of this helps.
How did you join the Art Ensemble? Or I should say, how did you co-found it?
Well, what happened is I moved to Chicago. I was married at that time to Fontella Bass, and she got a hit called Rescue Me, and we moved to Chicago. And after playing in the studios and doing the jingles for about a year, I heard about Richard Abrams' experimental band, and I went and sat in with their experimental band, and the next day I was a member of the ACM, and Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman and I were all rehearsing together.
It must have seemed like a big leap at the time for you musically?
No, not actually. You have to understand it. You don't go from bag to bag in this music. You don't say, well, I'm jazz and I'm R&B. I've always wanted to be a jazz musician. I've never wanted to be anything other than a jazz musician. But I also knew that I may have had to be a country and western musician to survive until I could play jazz for a living. So it all works together. One helps the other. I mean, my R&B experience helps me right now. My jazz experience helps me when I go to India or to Africa to play. You know, if you can play bebop, you can play just about anything. You know all the patterns of just about any music in the world. So I can use my bebop experience to help me play Chinese music. I can use the Chinese experience to help me further enhance or play something new on something else. So it all works together. You don't try to be just, you know, it's not just like one at a time. I'm R&B for a couple of years and I'm into jazz. It all kind of fuses together.
You're going to be performing at New Music America.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about what you're doing there.
Well, this is going to be a little bit different. We've got Brass Fantasy, six-piece gospel chorus, and six actors and actresses. So we're going to do something quite interesting. The name of it is 23 Facts in 3 Acts. And there's going to be 3 different acts of this performance.
Well, good luck with it. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy has a new record called Serious Fun on the Japanese label DIW. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're working on at All Things Considered. Robert Siegel is with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to hear a report on today's program by Linda Wertheimer on the race for governor of Virginia. It's between Democrat Douglas Wilder and Republican Marshall Coleman. Big issue in the race has been abortion. Wilder, pro-choice. Coleman is against abortion. Also, it's a very, very critical race because should Wilder win, it'll be the first election of a black governor ever. We'll also be hearing about the controversy over a resolution passed by the District of Columbia City Council that praises Minister Louis Farrakhan for his work in fighting drug abuse in the city.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The makers of Breck hair care products are now accepting applications for their 1990 Breck Woman. You may remember when the Breck Woman was the Breck Girl, and the shampoo ads she appeared in were dreamy illustrations instead of photographs. Patricia McLaughlin reflects on how things have changed.
When I was 15, I would have given anything to look like the Breck Girl. She was all over the place then, on the back covers of half the magazines published in America. She was perfect. Perfect skin, perfect features, and especially perfect hair. It was usually long and always shiny and absolutely manageable, so obedient that you could still see where the teeth of the comb had passed through it. My hair looked like Brillo then. Go brush your hair, my mother used to tell me. You look like the wild woman of Borneo. Somewhere in high school, I finally figured out how to smooth it out with gargantuan rollers. On rainy days, it would have turned back into Brillo by the time I got to school. You could tell this never happened to the Breck girl. You could tell nothing bad happened to her. Nobody nagged her to clean her room or wash the dinner dishes. No little sisters absconded with her last decent pair of knee socks 10 minutes before she had to leave for school. She looked like she'd never had an argument in her life. This was a tribute not so much to the sweet-temperedness of the gorgeous women who posed for those covers. Famous models like Kim Basinger, Sybil Shepherd, Cheryl Teagues, and Brooke Shields. But to an illustrator with the unlikely name of Ralph William Williams. He did their portraits in soft pastels, perfecting each one of them in the process and turning her into the Brett girl, a type as recognizable and as right for its time as the Gibson girl was for hers. Sweet, daydreamy, as well-behaved as her hair. This was probably what finished the Brett girl finally. By the early 70s, that kind of bland perfection seemed irrelevant. I hardly noticed when she disappeared from the magazine covers in 1978. But what goes around comes around. Breck revived her a couple of years ago, and of course they quickly updated her into the Breck woman. Now she's more than just a pretty head of hair. The 1989 Breck woman, Pam Chu, teaches French and Italian at the University of Tulsa. She has a husband and a 2-year-old daughter to keep up with. She teaches English to refugees in her spare time. She seems like a neat person. I talked to her on the phone yesterday, like somebody you'd like to live next door to or be friends with. She's even a big fan of fresh air. She's half Chinese, so she remembers the Brett girl on those old magazine covers as somebody she could never look like either.
I have very straight, thick, dark hair, and my skin is olive. And, of course, I have very dark eyes, no more blue. And my, well, just being the mix that I am, I don't have that all-American look.
You'd think I'd feel vindicated to have the Breck woman turn out to be somebody pretty much like me, a normal person with non-Breck girl hair. And I do. But I can't help feeling bad for the frizzy-haired teenager I was. Because then, I really believed those ads. I believed that if I had beautiful hair like the Breck girl, my life would be perfect. And I tried to have that kind of hair. And I suffered for not having it. And now, 30 years later, just like that, they change their minds. They come out and say, oh, go ahead, have any kind of hair you want. I quit believing in Brett girl hair a long time ago myself, but somehow I still feel betrayed.
Brunette Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. Naomi Person produces our reviews. They're edited and mixed by Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sharrock, and Karen Impola. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Philip Lopate takes a stand against joie de vivre and people with a zest for life. Poet John Haynes talks about the years he spent homesteading in Alaska. And TV critic David Bianculli looks back at 10 years of Nightline. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.